Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show,
Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network. Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
not talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Was it right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Trial your one with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Hey, we don't think I have tampered with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I'm Sam Amick, national writer at The Athletic, coming back to you after a fairly long hiatus on the podcasting front. Post-bubble, took a little bit of a breather, didn't have much of one. We went into free agency, we went into the draft, we went into this incredibly compacted COVID-19 NBA schedule. But the season is around the corner, and no better way to bring it in and break things down after a couple weeks of chaos and basketball madness than with the one and only Fred Katz, Wizards beat writer at The Athletic. Freddie, how are you, sir?
I'm wonderful. How about you?
Doing just fine. Good to see you. This is, you guys, we talked off air about this. This is part of my reintegration, and seeing coworkers again is fantastic. Y'all weren't in the bubble with me, so I like this. This is good. We also have Anthony Slater, Warriors beat writing extraordinaire, part-time Lakers analyst, and all things NBA. Slater, what's up, brother?
What's up? You mentioned compact offseason. There's nothing more compact than you're 90 minutes away from the team you cover about to make the number 2 overall pick. Very important pick. And then you learn the star shooting guard tore his Achilles. That was the bomb of the offseason. I was live on the radio when that happened too. That was,
how did you comport yourself? Did you meet the moment?
Well, I mean, suddenly it's like, you're making all these text messages and reaching out to people because, hey, you know, who are you going to select with this monumental choice in 90 minutes from now? What trades are you juggling? And then suddenly it's like, oh, wait, can we switch topics quick? Is Klay Thompson out for the season right now? And then, you think I was kind of like a little stunned by it. Can you imagine being in their war room? It was...
No, incredible. I mean, honestly, that might have been unprecedented in terms of the timing element you're talking about. And we're going to get into that and everything else all around the entire association, even though these guys cover the teams that I mentioned. We want to get to everything. We're going to break things down, guys, a little bit in a kind of a best and worst moves of the offseason, stuff that got your attention, stuff that made you scratch your head, stuff that made you nod and say, okay, good move. There's a lot that we could get into, but Slater, with your Warriors background, I'm going to start here and mention the Kelly Oubre move because, you talk about Klay getting hurt and then, the team having to scramble and also talk about unprecedented. We've never seen ever an owner and a franchise make such a costly decision like they did to go get a guy in Kelly Oubre who is a good ball player and he does – help to a degree fill what they lose with Klay Thompson. But when you're talking about, and tell me if the math has changed, but roughly an $85 million price tag, that was one of the many incredible moves of this offseason. Where does that fit on the old list for you?
High from a cojones factor, whatever you want. That was foot in the bill. And where it's this balance of, we don't want to sit here and be like, oh, billionaires spending money, like awesome job. But I did spend a large chunk of what was an extended offseason, 9 months, saying, hey, Joe Lacob, you talk about light years, you talk about, spending money, you're about to get the chance. Do not let this thing expire. If you do, you're going to get criticized locally. So, I mean, he should be praised for using it. The bill eventually will not be what it shows it'll be because, and I do think this is one of the main motivations why they used it, is they came out with the new CBA tweak that, basketball-related income, however percentage of that is lowered, that'll lower the tax bill. So it won't actually be that much, but it's still a very,
which upset a lot of other teams, right? Sorry to cut you off, but a lot of teams were not happy because for all intents and purposes, it helped the Warriors, you know, far more than anybody else.
It did, but I think when teams were upset, they thought, wow, the Warriors might add Kelly Oubre as a sixth man behind Klay Thompson. Now it's like in replace of Klay Thompson. That's what makes the move crazy is Lacob did it to be a five seed, to be a six seed. You know, like it wasn't the final piece to like guarantee a title, which would come back, you know, monetarily. But this is him, I think this is him understanding, like, I'd particularly after a year of irrelevance in their first season in Chase Center, like they can't go through that again. Even if Chase Center's empty, he doesn't want the Warriors to be irrelevant this year. And he at least made sure opening night we're going to watch him. I think throughout the season we're going to monitor where they are in the standings. Whereas you don't get Oubre, it's almost like a depressing season without Klay Thompson.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question here. How much of the Oubre trade had to do with not necessarily just we can get the six or we can get the five or we can get the four seed or whatever it might be, but just giving Steph a chance at the back end of his prime? Like, how good do they believe Steph is going to be this year? Because ultimately, if you get 2015, 2016 Steph, he's so good that you basically can't be a bad team if he's that good. Do they believe he's going to be that good this year? Or do they believe, all right, we get this, Steph is still really good, and then we still have three or four other players who are going to be able to complement him and make us a winning team?
I think there's two answers to the question. Number one, yeah, they do believe Steph is going to age like Steve Nash, essentially. I mean, if you look at Nash's career path, it's kind of crazy. When did he win MVP? Like 34, 35?
Sure.
And
my mind went to a different place. I'm thinking back problems and a rough ending. But I guess you're right. Before that, he was very durable.
I mean, and like, you know, Steph has had his injury issues, and I'm not saying they're saying Steph's career is going to end at 39 like Steve's did. But, you know, they think the skill, the condition he keeps himself in, the hand-eye coordination, like that's going to age so well. And just like he's still, you know, if you take him on the court and say, hey, run laps right now with this entire team, he's smoking the 23-year-olds on the team. So they do think he's going to have a great season. And yes, part of just this entire offseason is like maximize the Steph window. It is also the Draymond window, and it was the Klay Thompson window. But I think the Oubre move, particularly the timing of it, was, and you know, Joe Lacob apparently, so they get the news about Klay, and then there's this whole like, whoa, how does this change things? What's going on? It's like a spiraling franchise, and apparently he gathered the whole front office together. This is what he told Tim Kawakami on Tim's podcast. 90 minutes after, or you know, right before the draft, it was like, we're not tanking. Give me options. We're still going to go for it this year. And I think pulling the trigger on the Oubre move, and trust me, everyone in that organization knows what that financially meant, was about saying, like, you know, don't be sullen about this. You know, don't be kind of thinking everything's over. Like, go for it this year. And that's about Steph, but to me, that's about everybody in the organization.
Good stuff, guys. Let's kind of broaden the scope a little bit. Fred, you're sitting, and where are you at now, Fred? Not to get too personal. Where's home at the moment?
I'm in New York right now.
Okay, I know you kind of relocated a few times, but you're in your place in New York, and you're tracking the action. You're making calls, whether free agency, draft, all of the above, just the off season. Give us the move that left that jaw, you know, all the way on the floor, and the one, for positive or negative, the one that you not only didn't see coming, but think could have a lasting impact.
So can I say a conjunction of moves here?
Sure. You're right. Conjunctions are allowed.
Yeah. everything Oklahoma City did. The entire
way to stay on brand. Way to stay on brand.
That was okay. I thought he was just going to go Steven Adams move. I thought he was going to just go right to the.
No, the entire Sam Presti summer to me was, we knew it was coming. We knew he was going to tear it down, but that entire Sam Presti summer was outrageous and almost comical. How many first round picks he was stockpiling, and to be honest, I mean, look, it's all kind of interconnected to me, where you receive picks to take on Chris Paul, and then you get a pick to give up Chris Paul. You're you're taking something on and then turning it into greater value and then flipping it. Two of the other guys who you get in that deal, Kelly Oubre, who we just talked about, and Ricky Rubio, who come over from Phoenix in the Chris Paul deal, you flip for more stuff. You end up getting a pick for taking on Horford. I did not think they were going to get a first for Steven Adams. They got so much value into a team that I don't know if they... I have no idea if they expected to get this much this summer, but I can't imagine they expected to be able to flip the pieces they had for more. And there were some other like value stuff that I thought was really interesting. I loved what the Lakers did with their centers. I think getting Harrell for the mid-level exception, that was not something I expected, and complimenting him with Marc Gasol, I think just makes a lot of sense. I just kind of basketball nerdily love the Chris Dunn signing in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I thought
that's a good one. Hold on, before you move from Fred, before you go on from the Thunder, because again, it's on brand, and I like that you did that, but
let's go on brand. Why not be on brand?
Well, I'm about to be in a minute with my Sacramento Kings, Bucks, Bogdan Bogdanovich discussion, but we'll get to that. What I love is that I don't have the memory recall to sit here for the listeners and break down every Sam Presti move. But in the absence of that, what I was just attempting to do on my other screen here was to, I looked at David Aldridge's power rankings where he broke down every move that teams made, where they fall. So he's got the Thunder dead last, which is not surprising, 30th. But my favorite part of the way he broke it down is he has a feature that says, you know, who they added, who they lost, and every single detail. That part of the article is 269 words. That's a lot of off-season activity. And then it's got a category that says it says retained, you know, players retained, and it just says none. Just none. Nobody. Nobody's around. So Sam was wheeling and dealing. But now, okay, continue. Well, you had another move to mention.
Quickly, before my favorite part of the whole Thunder off-season was, I mean, we all know Barry Trammell, and we know, you know, the local, he doesn't actually tweet, but whenever he puts up a blog post, it like auto-feeds his like empty Twitter with whatever it was with the link. And, you know, obviously everyone, you know, there's so much wheeling and dealing, so you're on Twitter and everyone's giving opinions and stuff, and then suddenly a Barry Trammell tweet pops up, which is just a blog post he put out that just said, "I just can't even keep up with the Thunder roster right now." And I'm like, this is it. And I was like thinking about it. I was like, yeah, like we're debating all these trades and draft picks moving and which Thunder pieces are going where. And it's just like, what does their actual roster look like? And it's like Trevor Ariza's there. Like, who is like their starting lineup this year? I don't even know.
Well, but it's fascinating, and this extends way beyond the Thunder. I would love to talk, and actually this is a good idea, talk to some executives going forward about the calculus in this particular offseason relating to the what is hopefully going to be a once-in-a-lifetime reality that you're not going to have fans. Now, certainly there might be a small amount of fans in some arenas, but what's interesting is that, I mean, if you're Sam Presti, just never a better time to tear it down than when you're going to be in an empty building. And even in my backyard, you know, that's been a discussion, you know, for the Kings and the idea that, okay, they – were pushing for the playoffs last couple of years, but that group didn't really get it done and they were overpriced. And new GM Monty McNair has been sending some pretty strong signals that, you know, he's not going to do a whole tear down. You got De'Aaron Fox on a extension and you got young pieces, but you know, the debate is when you don't have fans to be unhappy at the games, certainly the ones watching on TV, they care, but guess what? When they're not in the building, you don't have to worry about booing. You don't have to worry about, you know, the negativity that kind of hits you differently. So that part, I guarantee you, it came into the, you know, the thought process with some of these teams, and you know, a guy like Sam, I think his timing is great. So you know, they did a lot trying to figure out where else y'all want to go. The Bogdanovich thing.
Well, so Sam, before you move on from that, one thing I've thought about too is the exact opposite of that effect, because I cover John Wall. And so I've been looking at John Wall trade market and even the Russell Westbrook trade market. And one of the things that we constantly say about teams like, I mean, I know the Hornets have Devontae Graham and they have Terry Rozier and they have LaMelo now. But one of the things that we constantly say about teams like the Hornets are, well, they want to put people in the seats, right? Go get so-and-so and maybe they'll be able to put people in the seats. Well, the Hornets, Rick Bunnell just reported today, the Hornets are literally not going to have fans in the seats this year. So that's completely taken off the table. So when you're talking about a market for Russell Westbrook, who does get people in the building, or John Wall, who does get people in the building, especially
or
for
paying
a team
Gordon
like,
Hayward $120 million.
Yeah. That too. They
By the
did
way,
that.
That was that's high on my list of worst moves.
I know, and we got the list is long. We got to make sure we get through it. That one is a tough one, and even tougher to your point, Fred, that you're not even getting the fringe benefit of semi pleasing the locals in the building,
or just the money. It's not even like fan morale. It's just the money. If the Hornets, I don't know what percentage of gate the Hornets sold last year. Let's say they sold 70%. If they have a John Wall who's from North Carolina on that team, maybe they think they sell 90%. Maybe they think half their games are sellouts now, and like they're not gonna make back that money now. At least not this season. They're just not. Right.
No, that's a very good point. We're going stream of consciousness here, Slater. How do you see the Hayward move? And before you jump in, I mean, I was on Team DA. David Aldridge and I did a roundtable with some of the other guys on the national desk breaking down the Hayward signing. And it's not an endorsement by any means. I think my stance was just that I get it. I get the idea that you're going to overpay in a small market. I get the idea that with Gordon, I think the only saving grace for me, and I think for sure I'm in the minority here, is that I kind of liked what I saw out of him in the playoffs up close before he dealt with what I think was an ankle at the end. But other teams that were going after Gordon, for one, he had at least $100 million on the table elsewhere. I don't know all the offers, but he definitely had $100 million from a different squad that is in Georgia. and they thought that, you know, he was on the come up, and that at, you know, this age, and that his injuries were all different enough that there was not a through line that you know left them with a red flag regarding who he was going to be in the next couple of years. I think it is obviously a tough sell. You know, you buying any of that, or are you just 100% saying just should not have gone that way?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, he's got to be tied to the Batum stretch and wave, which is a problem because that's. But, you know, I don't like the stretch and wave ever because I think you're putting money on your books later when you don't know what type of moves you're going to need, particularly around your new rookie, LaMelo Ball. But if we're adding the Batum money to Hayward, you're basically paying Gordon Hayward essentially $40 million over the next few years because I think it's an extra $9 million every year for Batum now. And then...
this is coming from the guy. You're endorsing the $80 million move for Oubre and you can't even sign off on...
Well, to me, it's more about kidding. Like the smart, I got you. But, it, you know, it's the cap room, too. And you know, you might be right. And Gordon Hayward did look solid in the bubble. And so let's say Gordon Hayward makes the Hornets an 8 seed this year. You know, I think in theory, they're like, yes, that's exactly why we got him. We wanted to be competitive with LaMelo. We wanted to at least get, even if you can't get fans in the building, you get some local energy around the team. But to me, you should be in the Cade Cunningham sweepstakes. You should be trying to be bad like the Thunder, like the Kings this year in a loaded 2021 draft. And because you're trying to build around LaMelo, not just have, you know, LaMelo have an okay rookie and sophomore season before Gordon Hayward really ages out. And then suddenly, you know, I don't know. To me, it's just like it's the wrong version of team building 101.
Not only, I mean, now I'm flipping a little bit. The one thing that didn't land well with me is somebody had tweeted, you know, astutely that, you know, they wouldn't pay Kemba Walker, but then they pay Gordon Hayward. And the irony of, you know, taking a guy in Gordon out of Boston while you let Kemba go to Boston. And I get that there was a lot of history there, but if, in fact, the goal was to, you know, kind of be at this level, you know, Kemba certainly could have gotten him there. Now, LaMelo, obviously you would have had duplication there, and they probably don't wind up drafting him, but... I just think small markets in general are up against it, and we see Sam Presti on one end of the spectrum doing it the way he's doing it, and we'll see if that pays off. It's got shades of, you know, it's not a process from the Philly years by any means, but in terms of assets, now we see how many, you know, times can he hit when he's got all these bites at the apple. And then with Charlotte, you know, they're trying to retain interest. I think, you know, Michael Jordan's ownership tenure obviously has been extremely mediocre for a very long time, and we'll see where this goes. The next one, guys, to jump into, and Slater, this is a little bit up your alley, but Freddie, jump in here too, is what do we think of what the defending champions did? There's a lot of layers to this. They were willing to deal, and I think in the end it was three starters that are on the way out. Not the kind of thing that you see from champions, but, you know, a lot of things that I thought ultimately are going to pay off. A Marc Gasol addition is the latest one. Getting Dennis Schroeder in there. Obviously, Rajon Rondo goes to Atlanta. The Lakers were busy. Rob Pelinka, the much maligned GM, who's had a bit of a revival here and changing of his reputation, was extremely busy. How do you see what they did?
I thought they had a great offseason. I was going to say summer, but I guess they had a great,
great winter.
They had a great 1 week in November, a great Thanksgiving season. They kind of added wherever they needed to add. When the Harrell signing came in at first, I thought, okay, that's really good value, but I wonder exactly how the fit is. Like, I figured there has to be somebody else coming in there who's going to fit them a little bit better to complement Harrell, because even next to Anthony Davis, I'm not sure it's the best thing in the world to have him as a starter. And then they bring in Gasol, and I'm like, okay, well, that makes perfect sense. Where I know Gasol looked terrible in the playoffs last year. He looked really bad in the bubble, but he had a really nice season. Like, if you asked people in Toronto last year about who is the guy who you think is under, I mean, everyone knows about Lowry, everybody knows about Siakam, but who is, like, the guy who's holding together your defense? Like, Gasol was mentioned up there with OG Anunoby and those other guys as a guy who was really important to their team defense. And I think if you put him next to Anthony Davis, like, that defense, I mean, Anthony Davis makes up for a lot of Gasol's speed flaws, you know, with the way that he flies around defensively, protects the rim, does everything unbelievably. So I thought, and then bringing in Schroeder, I think, will help them too as another playmaker. And we'll see how he runs pick and rolls with Harrell. We'll see how Harrell does without Lou Williams running those pick and rolls. But I could see that all working really nicely.
I liked it less than most people. I'm not
controversy.
Yeah, I'm not really high on the Harrell move. You know, because when we're talking about winning titles, we're not talking like they're going to be a better regular season team, and Harrell and Dennis Schroeder are basically going to be Harrell and Lou Williams over now. You know, on the other side of the Staples Center hallway, and that will be useful when LeBron wants to take off games, and Anthony Davis maybe, you know, has a little, you know, hip tweak or something and takes off a few straight weeks or something like that. Oh, suddenly you can just Harrell Schroeder pick and roll teams to death. You win more regular season games and you get more rest for your stars. But it's about playoff matchups. And Dwight Howard, a guy that apparently thought he was going to be back on the Lakers for about 10 minutes and had to delete his own tweet.
That was unbelievable.
That really was unbelievable. he was...
Hold on, just in case the listeners didn't see it, there's no way they didn't. But I mean, we've never seen a guy tweet out his own news. And I forget, did he have he put out a picture of a Lakers jersey? Is that what he did?
I don't remember if it was a picture, but he said, like, Laker Nation, I'm back. And then it was
right,
like,
right.
Delete.
And then, I mean, listen, this is your only as good, you know, Dwight was the one putting this information out there. So Arsham Sharania tweets that Dwight's going to the Lakers. Then, you know, subsequently very quickly tweets Dwight is still considering his options. And then I think, you know, 72 seconds later or something like that, it was Philly. So here comes Daryl Morey with his old buddy from their Houston days, you know, bringing Dwight in. But yeah, that was one of the many surreal moments.
It was funny.
Look, I like most beat writers, have covered Dwight Howard. And I'll say that was the perfect way for the Dwight Howard Lakers era to end. It was I never knew after 2012 that we needed Dwight to go back, redeem himself as a legitimately really good role player, win a title, and then leave in the goofiest fashion that we could ever possibly. I mean, I was giggling when that happened, like legitimately home alone in my living room, just giggling, thinking of all the goofy things Dwight has said to me and I've witnessed him do and think, yep. Yep, this one is an epic one.
Slater, I feel you on the Montrez thing. What? It's funny because at first I was digging it, and admittedly, I was digging it mainly from the rivalry standpoint. I just thought it was kind of a baller move to go get, you know, a guy who was an important piece of the Clippers plan last year. But playoff matchups, like you said, matter a lot. And Montrez in particular, now I think it'll work better with the Lakers from a locker room dynamic standpoint, because there is a very clear pecking order, right? The one problem in Clipperland, from my perspective, was that when you had Montrez and Lou and Pat Beverly having actually accomplished, you know, something of substance the year prior to Paul George and Kawhi Leonard showing up, I always thought that created a sticky dynamic where Montrez felt a certain sense of ownership over their culture and their locker room that is going to just be different with the Lakers. Everybody knows who's running the Lakers and kind of who's in charge now. But, you know, defensively, he's got question marks, and, you know, they didn't struggle to score to begin with. So, you know, I think a lot of your points are valid here.
Well, the reason why I mentioned Dwight Howard was Dwight Howard, and Sam, you wrote plenty about it while it was going on, was the Nikola Jokic irritant in the West Finals.
Right.
You know, whatever Batman. You want to say about, you know, geez, whatever you want to say about his, you know, antics, whatever, like he bothered Jokic, and they won that series in a decent part because of what Howard did energy wise, defensively, blocking shots, just bothering the whole Nuggets team. Wolf rewinded one series. Why were the Nuggets in that series? Because Nikola Jokic killed Montrezl Harrell. Montrezl Harrell was -58 in that series when Nikola Jokic was on the floor. I think people that have more insider access in the bubble to me would say Montrezl Harrell wasn't himself in the bubble, and like you'll see a different Montrezl Harrell coming up. But the what I guess I found most curious about the Lakers offseason is, and in general, I would agree with you guys, they probably got better, and we're talking about a defending champ getting better, but they pretty much ignored the bubble. Marcus Gasol, really bad in the bubble. Montrezl right. Harrell, really bad in the bubble. Rajon Rondo, really good in the bubble. Dwight Howard, really good in the bubble. And
the Lakers, as previously constructed, pretty good in the bubble.
Yes.
And nothing but change.
And they flipped it up. Now, I do think their last few moves salvaged it, where if KCP left for bigger money, I think that was going to be a big problem, but they got him back. Maybe they were always going to get him back.
He was good in the playoffs.
Yeah, he was very good. Yeah. He was their third best player. I do think, you know, I think, again, Schroeder's a better regular season player than Rondo. That Rondo I saw in the playoffs was awesome, but maybe the Lakers are betting they're not getting that again. So, in general, probably better. But, man, Marc Gasol better not be cooked, because if Marc Gasol is cooked, they could have some matchup problems in the playoffs. And I can flip it back to you guys. The move I like the most, that I think may have had the most impact on this year's title, was the Clippers replacing Harrell with Serge Ibaka.
Yeah.
I think that makes them better.
That's where I thought you were going
to go. I think that makes them better.
I like that move a lot. I mean, and again, I'm a little obsessed with, you know, we've written a lot about this with myself and Jovan Buhar, our Clippers beat writer, like the Clippers chemistry, the interpersonal dynamics. You're bringing a guy, so you sub out Montrez, who I already explained some of the dynamic there that was not always positive. Let's not forget, he was the guy during the regular season who, in front of the media, you know, essentially pulled the curtain back on what was happening internally with their group and talked openly about how, you know, you guys need to stop talking about us like we're a championship team. We haven't done anything. And you could sense kind of the tension there. Now you bring in a guy in Serge Ibaka who had, by all accounts, very positive dynamic with Kawhi Leonard in Toronto, a guy who checks boxes that Montrez simply doesn't check. And I'm with you for sure. The Clippers, for a minute, looked like they were, you know, going to become one of the losers of this offseason, and that was a great move.
I feel like people, for the most part, kind of don't even realize how good Ibaka was last year, too. Yeah. I mean, he shot the hell out of the ball and was, again, really, really excellent defensively. I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in, and I don't know how much this necessarily applies to Ibaka, because the Clippers obviously have so much defensive personnel and are going to be able to put together some killer defensive lineups. But one of the things that I've been so interested in, and this definitely probably applies to Gasol, even though I was just praising his regular season defense earlier, how much of what we see from Toronto's defense, where that team played on a string last year, as well as they played telepathically, right? they played as well as any other defense played last year in terms of just team defense. One guy moves, the other guy is helping the helper the second he starts to take a step in any direction, right? And I'm curious to see how some of these guys do out of Toronto when they're not in that environment, they're not with those particular teammates. Ibaka has obviously always been a really, really good defender. I don't know if it affects him as much. It might affect Gasol as much, which runs a little bit counter a little bit more, which might run a counter a little bit to what I was saying before. But Ibaka was a big part last year of that defending on a string with them. He was so good, especially in moments when he had to come off the bench. He's going to provide legitimate defensive help for them, and he's going to be able to hit threes. And man, like that's I agree with you guys that like Harrell is, he's a very good regular season player, and I think that's going to help the Lakers a lot, especially in a condensed season with more back-to-backs when LeBron is 35 coming off of no offseason at all. I think that's going to help the Lakers a lot. But I actually agree with Slater that I think Ibaka is an upgrade there for the Clippers in terms of just their chances at winning a title.
Well, and you know, DA made this point on his Hoops Adjacent pod also that the Montrez move looked fantastic and it was kind of the shiny new object in the beginning of free agency. But then you take a step back and you wonder what kind of market he had because he committed very quickly. And then in his media interviews made it really clear the Clippers weren't coming after him. And I don't know what else he might have been able to look at. And you have the connection, of course, between Montrez and AD and LeBron with the Clutch agency and represented by Rich Paul. But, yeah, the Clippers, you know, they end up, excuse me, coming up strong on the back end. Gentlemen, we're going to take some questions from listeners here in a few minutes. But before we go down that road, you guys know me well enough to know that any opportunity I have to talk about tampering on the old Tampering podcast, I'm just going to lean into it. And this Bogdan Bogdanovic mess, which is the way we phrased it on our headline, where I co-wrote a story with Eric Name, our Bucks beat writer. I feel like I've said this a lot in the past year or so, but like yet again, a story the likes of which I don't remember covering, something that was very different where 5 days before free agency, you know, story breaks that Bogdanovic is part of a agreed upon signed a trade between the Kings and the Bucks, and, you know, rave reviews all over the place for the Bucks and what this would mean, because as you guys know, at that time, they had landed Jrue Holiday, and it just looked like, man, they are just making this incredible surge over the finish line to go secure Giannis Antetokounmpo and that Supermax extension that they're hoping he signs here pretty soon. The Bogdanovic deal ends up falling apart, as we had first reported, and, you know, he ends up signing with the Hawks. There's a lot of layers to this one, but, you know, for one, the thing that has not been hit on all that much, and admittedly, and you guys can relate, you know how when you write a piece and you try to use your best stuff and you try to push yourself to tell the readers what's truly happening, and then every once in a while you go back and look at your story and you're like, oh man, I forgot about this tidbit, or I didn't include this. So this is in that category for me. The one overlooked component of the Bucks situation, without even getting into, okay, when did the teams talk? And by the way, there's still an investigation of both teams for the tampering charges, so we'll see what happens there. But when the Bucks did the Holiday move, the one thing that really got glossed over from Bogdanovic's perspective is that two things happen. For one, it's counterintuitive because Jrue Holiday is a great player, and then you would assume a guy like Bogdanovic would want to be part of a title contender that now has Jrue Holiday instead of George Hill, right? And with Chris Middleton and Giannis and the rest of that group. But when the Holiday move happened, that ripple effect was this. Bogdanovic then became, for all intents and purposes, a fourth option, which my reporting had bared out that he wasn't necessarily feeling that. And then secondly, the money, I don't know the specific numbers, but I mean, the money was impacted potentially in terms of once they got Holiday, what they could offer Bogdan. And it seems as if, you know, whatever agreement was in place before, and Bogdan's camp certainly all the way through said there was never an agreement from him, but he was talking to Giannis on a fairly routine basis. Giannis pushed very hard, wanted Bogdan on that team. As an aside, and I mentioned George Hill a second ago, I mean, I was also told that George Hill had been recruiting Bogdan before the Holiday trade, and there was a little bit of a sense of, wait a minute, man, I thought I was coming to play with you. Like, you know, what happened here? So tons of layers to this thing, and the Hawks were more than happy to come you know, take advantage of it and continue what was a really good offseason for them. But, you know, you guys watched all that stuff unfold. Where, you know, how do you see the Bogdan stuff?
The part, particularly as you kind of like tell the TikTok a little bit there, it's just bad communication from Bucks management at a time where they're trying to, you know, hold steady a potential disaster of, you know, like Giannis leaving, and then they have all their first round picks in subsequent years, which would be probably lottery picks going to New Orleans. You just, again, I'm not on the inside of it, but it just seems like you got to be a little bit sharper with your communication there.
Sure.
On the back end, and either not letting stuff leak to the media or just like, you know, letting your stars know what's going on. I mean, like, again, I don't know what Giannis did or didn't know, but it sounds to me like you said, people within the core of the Bucks thought one thing was happening, and suddenly the Holiday move, which I do like for their title chances, sounds like it might have blindsided some people, and it's just, it's not a good time for stuff like that to happen. I will just say that.
No, it's not. And I do ultimately think, we'll see if this bears out. I would be surprised if Giannis doesn't sign the Supermax. You know, he headed back from Greece, I believe, yesterday. I actually texted today with Eric Name, our Bucks beat writer, about that. You know, and so I would expect some noise on that front, you know, throughout the course of this week. But it's not a good time for that. And I think it speaks to how hard it is to, you know, during especially a compressed offseason like this one was, to manage all these moving parts and to not stub your toe, for lack of a better way of putting it. And even if they ultimately get Giannis to sign that dotted line, I think there's really no arguing the fact that, you know, that's what happened here.
Yeah, you know, one thing that just I've found the most fascinating about this is just, and I'm sure you guys have encountered the same sort of thing, so many people around the league were so pissed about that entire situation.
Right.
Like, which really is a pretty pissed. Great,
but my favorite part, Fred, is it really pissed. Like, a lot, I would love to see Adam Silver's phone and you know.
Oh my God.
I guarantee you it's a lot of the same teams that want Giannis in free agency next year.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, one executive who I talked to about it, and I don't know if his team was trying to blow the whistle and was in that group, but to his credit, he made the point to say, listen, like, talk about the pot calling the kettle black, like a bunch of teams, you know, coming in and complaining about the very thing that they do all the time. This particular time, they just didn't like it because it might have improved the Bucks' chances at holding on to Giannis. But, you know, it upset a lot of people, and it put the league in a hard spot because, I don't know, I hate to say it, the league seems to, when it comes to tampering, yeah, they came down hard last September. They, you know, they increased the rules, they increased the penalties. They have executives worried about the prospect of maybe even getting sidelined. Like, if you're a GM and you get caught, you could, you know, be out of a commission for a couple years. It's serious stuff, but they seem to only really ramp up the investigations when they have a black eye publicly, you know, when you embarrass them. I'm not sure how much they truly care about, you know, the depth of conversations happening outside of you know, the boundaries in reality. They just don't like it when you embarrass them.
Yeah, look, it's all perception. I mean, clearly it's all perception. When these deals happen at 6:01 or what used to be 12:01, I highly doubt they're doing, you know, speed dating conversations in which they work right out all the details of a contract within, you know, 30 seconds. I mean, it's all a perception thing. But one thing that I'm so curious about is, all right, if the let's forget about the rationality or even the potential hypocrisy of being incredibly upset with the Bucks over that entire situation. If the whole league is really upset, they don't really have many people standing in their corner saying, you know what, we all do it, it's fine. And if it is, like you said, a black eye for the league, then how's the league going to handle that? I mean, like, the thing that I've been thinking about is the, like, Sam, you know more about this than I do. Is this a Joe Smith situation? Where the Timberwolves circumvented the cap to sign Joe Smith 20 years ago, and the league ended up taking away just tons of draft picks for years and essentially decimated the Timberwolves with, of course, the help of the Timberwolves for years and years and years?
I don't think so. I do need to make some calls on it this week, to be honest with you. I think that they certainly relieved pressure by not trying to continue with this move. You know, when after the news of the investigation had come out, there was still a sense that the Bucks might get a meeting with Bogdan. And then a lot of people around the league saying that this entire storyline in the media was nothing but public cover for a deal that was ultimately still going to go down. And so you thought that Bogdan was going to maybe meet with them. I remember, you know, hearing that maybe Giannis would come back early to kind of wine and dine him a little bit. I think if they had done that and forced the issue, that there was a chance the league would have come in and blown it up, even though it would have been a different construction of the original deal. As you guys know, Ersan Ilyasova was in the original trade. He ended up, they picked up or guaranteed his money. No, I'm sorry. They waived him, and that made the construction different. The fact that he's in a Hawks jersey, I think, is going to put everybody in the clear, but we shall see. There, I can tell you firsthand that in terms of the seriousness of it, you know, I mean, people who otherwise are fairly chatty in terms of talking about their teams and what they're doing got very tight, you know, and very quiet. And there was a real seriousness about people who normally would be more than happy to kind of hear your questions and give you insight. They're not messing around with this one. I mean, there's audits involved. You know, I don't know how, if they're getting people's phones and really trying to get to the bottom of this, you know, and again, no clarity there, but the league was not happy. And the other side of that though, and this doesn't necessarily excuse whoever was at fault, if anybody in that situation, is that we keep going back to the uniqueness of this offseason. You know, I had another agent who was not involved in this just kind of telling me, like, Sam, what did the league expect? Like, you put us in a situation where these players, and this is just a league-wide commentary, like, these players are trying to figure out their lives. Forget about how rich they are. Like, it's just life. They want to know where they're going to play. They want to pick the best option. And, you know, and you made it, you know, incredibly hard to go through that process, not only because of the COVID restrictions that are not their fault, but the timeline, you know, pushing the season up from mid-January to mid-December, essentially, for lack of a better way of putting it, stressed everybody out. And I think, honestly, compelled a lot of people to not care as much about the rules as they would have otherwise, you know, and we all know that that's minimal at best to begin with. So all those things to me, you know, led to these types of situations happening.
I don't think there needs to be any more punishment than, hey, they got fined, you know, whatever, $100,000. The punishment is they don't have Bogdanovich, which I think hurts their team and potentially their, you know, ability to retain Giannis long term. But again, it speaks to not only, you know, I mentioned the lack of clear communication they might have had within their team about the string of moves they were making, but how can you let this get out? What was it? 4 days before free agency?
It's weird. Yeah.
Yeah. That.
And I don't. I if I knew who, where it came from, yeah, I wouldn't share it. So, but I can share it like that. I don't know. I don't have clarity on where it came from. There's people who think both sides. There's whatever. But you always look at incentive. Who had incentive? And again, because I've said I truly don't know, I feel okay saying this. My first thought was, you know, the Bucks essentially did a victory lap when this news came out, because it was like, look at us essentially telling the rest of the league, like, stop coming after Giannis, like, we have him, you know.
It came right after the holiday move, right? It almost felt, yeah, like me, like you said, I don't know how it happened, but it almost felt like me, it was like, yeah, we got Holiday, wait till you see who else we got. And it was like right. You know, it was like right. That, because it was so, I'm trying to remember the exact timing of it, but it almost felt like the same night, right? It was like, wow, the Holiday move, yeah. And then it was like, oh, they also got Bogdanovich? And I was like, wait,
right?
How did they do right. that yet? So
it was the yeah, first day they could make
I'm
trades.
I'm not sure the Kings were, you know, rushing to tell their fan base that they got Dante DiVincenzo, you know, and I thought he would have fit in fine, but just not quite the same dynamics.
Yeah. Sam, you're going to have to change the name of this podcast to the Cap Circumvention Podcast now.
we'll talk about that on the next pod. I've heard a few interesting things this week about, you know, and maybe it's in the wake of the investigation, but the league, you know, getting even tougher on that front. Little perks that players normally get that they're not getting right now. I think the league's getting a little cranky on that front. Mr. Schlecht, I see your face there. You're rejoining the group. I think we are going to answer a few listener questions here. What do you got for us?
Maybe the most important question of the day. This is from our friend Mo DeKeel. Have you continued to play pickleball, Sam?
Mo has no idea how great that question is. It's very timely. I wish the listeners had video for this part. I would turn my camera and point it out my front window, which faces out to the court that we live on. And I kid you not, yesterday I was out there with my neighbor Luke. Got to give him a public shout out here for his help. A very good friend of mine who is also a contractor. And Luke helped me reconstruct the pickleball court on our court so that it wasn't so ragtag. So we have official pickleball dimensions, 44 feet length, 20 feet baseline. It's what is it? You know, I think 15 feet to the, I have it all memorized. So the court is set up. It is also very seasonal because it's part red and part green, which the kids love. And yeah, we're back in action, man. We were out there last night pickleballing in 35 degree weather. It was pretty great.
Amazing. this is from at Reese Wong. Do you expect Monty McNair to be active up until the deadline, or is he happy to see what the Kings can do and build towards 2022?
I expect him to be very active because he came from the Houston Rockets, you know, school of thought, which is, you know, activity at a level that really doesn't have any peer around the NBA. At least it didn't during the Daryl Morey era, just in terms of sometimes I think fans forget like what this entails from the human standpoint. It's text messages and phone calls all day long and conversations to explore opportunities. And it's just the old adage about, you know, turning over every rock. That's where Monty came from. That's his ethos. So I think he'll keep pushing, but I think the thing, the sense I get, I said it earlier, that he doesn't necessarily want to broadcast, but seems to be more and more clear, is that, like Slater said earlier, the draft coming up in 2021 is very, very strong. And just because the Kings have this playoff drought that is the longest in the NBA that their fans would love them to break, does not mean that a new executive like Monty McNair, I don't think that's his end game, is to break that streak this year. His end game is to, you know, get as talented a core as possible on the same, you know, at least close to the same age track with De'Aaron Fox, Marvin Bagley in that group.
Tyrese Halliburton. You know, now
Tyrese too. Halliburton. Yeah.
That was one of the best players of the draft. Pick. Yeah.
I mean, it really was. And he, with the crazy thing too, I mean, crazy or just surprising, is that, and I think Zach Lowe had this on his podcast with Jonathan Givony, is that like Halliburton really wanted to play for the Kings. He actually wanted to drop, and he likes De'Aaron's game and how he'll fit with him. And even after they drafted him, he was dropping references to, you know, C-Webb and Bibby and Vlade, like players who were playing when he was born. So he's going to be a fan favorite. But yeah, I think Monty will be active. He'll keep, you know, looking to kind of get the roster on the track he wants to get it on. It's just, it's not going to be a blockbuster move that, you know, gets them into contention.
Yeah. Is there any intel as to why Halliburton dropped?
Honestly, well, I mean, the sense is that I mean, I don't know all the ins and outs, but there was a sort, you know, certain orchestration happening with a message being sent that he was trying to get where he got. And I know that sounds surprising. It was surprising when I, you know, heard it on Zach's podcast, and then I did make a few phone calls to try to, like, you know, essentially just from my own reporting to kind of confirm that. And from all parties, that does seem to be the case where, you know, I don't know how they handled their workouts. I don't know all the ins and outs. I just know that you know, the Kings wanted him, but the more important part in terms of him dropping was that he actually wanted to get to that point.
Yeah. Maybe people thought that's weird enough that we got to let this guy get past us, that he wants to be a King.
Right. It also speaks to the parity in this draft, obviously, too.
Sure.
And just, you know, we all knew that there was, you didn't want the number one pick because you didn't know what you'd get. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of parity in this draft.
I think every move before Halliburton went to the Kings is defensible except for the Phoenix one. The Phoenix went for, like, a backup center right before it. Like, that. They either should have traded down or taken Halliburton, in my opinion. But, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not a draft expert, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Don't sell yourself short.
I'll tell you plenty about James Wiseman. I did a lot of research.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll get to that here in a second. At J.H. Allison wants to know, what do you think Charlotte offered teams to trade Batum instead of stretching his salary? First of all, do we know if they tried to trade him, and then two?
Yeah, yes. We know they tried to trade
him. Okay. Well, Fred,
there you go, Fred. I had nothing. Well, Fred's going
to
take this one.
Sounds like to the Wizards, potentially.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I don't know what the... I have no idea what was offered, but I was told they tried to trade him.
I I mean, if anyone was going
to
take...
I don't know how hard they tried to trade him for what it's worth. Like, I don't know if they just, like, called up, you know, the, like, three teams and said, you want Batum? And they said no, and that was it. But I think there was at least minimal effort. Maybe maximal effort. I don't know, but I know there were calls.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anyone should take... I mean, like, yeah, you have to make calls around, but who's going to say, yeah, we'll take on that contract?
There's few teams that could have done it. I mean, the Knicks are one because they had to clear, what was it, $8 million in cap space in order
to do the deal? Would have had to give up a future first rounder. And, like, if you're, again, I mean, well, we can question how they're building around LaMelo, but, like, you shouldn't be doing that if you're the Charlotte Hornets.
So. No, it's simultaneously the worst thing they could have done and also the right thing to do.
Well, in my opinion, the best thing they could have done is just had him on the roster next year, ate that money, and then not waived and stretched and attached it to the Hayward contract. But now we're in a circle back to the beginning of the podcast where I think that's
or you have to speed up. I realize this is easier said than done because sometimes Gordon Hayward has to agree right away too. But it's a lot easier to make that decision on, I was going to say, July 1st, whatever day free agency starts. The first day of free agency right away, or the first day of trades even, because you can start clearing stuff out at that point. It's a lot easier to make that decision early when there are already only four or five teams with consequential amount of cap space. Right off the bat, Phoenix makes the deal for Chris Paul, but like Detroit still has space. Maybe there's something they're interested there in taking on Batum, or you know, I doubt Atlanta would be down for that. But yeah, I mean, even the Knicks, before they make a couple of their other signings, so you get that out there. I don't think Charlotte really got on this until they had Gordon Hayward locked in. And by that point, it's like you only have the Knicks, and the Knicks don't even have enough space remaining to be able to take on Batum's whole contract. They still got to give something back because I think the Knicks are like, they had like $18 million in space or something like that at that time. So even the Knicks don't have, you know, they still got to create another $9 million or so in order to make a deal there work. I mean, it's just like the timing is really tough, and this is not really the summer to do it, especially once a team like, say, Detroit has already given out money to Mason Plumlee and Jeremy Grant and everybody else. And Detroit is trading for contracts literally so it can stretch them. That's where Detroit is at.
I know. Maybe, I was going to say, how did we get through a whole pod? We didn't even talk about the Pistons. Oh, well.
Last question. This is from at No Hype, Just Ball. Who will win Rookie of the Year? We'll throw it to you, Slater.
I think Obi Toppin. I think Obi Toppin is going to come in to the Knicks, who should have plenty of shots to go around. And, I mean, we all know he's, like, offensively ready to score in the league. You know, I don't know about defend at a high level ever. I think he's a low upside rookie. But you know, I if he just scores 16 per game for the Knicks in what is, we all agree, kind of like a pretty soft rookie class, I think that could win it. Now, you know, you probably kicked it to me because Wiseman is a name here that if he explodes right away, if he's just crushing lobs from Steph and running that pick and roll and blocking 1.5 shots per game, and the Warriors are a five, you know, an exciting 4 or 5 seed, and he's defending well next to Draymond, like, he definitely is in the conversation, but I'm going Toppin.
I could see LaMelo. LaMelo's going to have the hype just because he's a ball. Then you've got, we talked about Gordon and the way that his, you know, the status of his game. And Gordon's a playmaker. Gordon's a guy that does make, I think, players around him better. I could see LaMelo with a halfway decent rookie year getting that done. And then since we just hit on it, I wonder about Halliburton. Like, if you have, you know, a Kings core that is young and they're coming in with, you know, 30 wins and having some exciting nights in the arena, but he's a legitimate piece in terms of what they're doing. Because that was part of the Bogdanovich move with the Kings not matching, was the idea that if you match on Bogdanovich and now you have Harrison Barnes and De'Aaron Fox and Marvin Bagley and all these pieces, that, you know, Halliburton's not going to get a ton of time. So he'd be a dark horse, but I could definitely see LaMelo winning it.
We have not mentioned the number one overall pick either, which probably kind of tells you how most people think of him as a number one overall pick. But he's interesting. I mean, particularly if watching it through a Warriors lens, because they have the Wolves first round pick in this loaded draft we're talking about. I'm curious to see that the first month, like this Towns, Russell, Edwards team in Minnesota that I don't know how it's going to work, but I think they're going to be the type of team that's losing 135-127 on a nightly basis.
Yeah, right. I was very upset Slater said that because now I look unoriginal. But yeah, I think Toppin is a really good winning rookie of the year because of the counting numbers pick. Like, yeah. It's the Knicks. I could see him averaging 20 a game this year. Like, that's within the realm of possibilities, right? I mean, look at that roster.
20's bold. And they're 20's bold.
I feel like it's possible. His offensive game is amazing. Like, with the efficiency that he scored with, considering his volume last year, was outrageous. And I feel like as a scorer, there aren't that many obvious, I mean, there are obvious weaknesses to his games, especially defensively, but just purely as a scorer, I feel like his game is incredibly refined for a rookie. I like him.
You know who he reminds me of? And he's going to New York. David Lee, you know, I think he's going to,
that's a great one.
He's going to be, you know, pick and roll, double machine where like, then he gets in a winning environment like David Lee eventually did with the Warriors. And it's like, you know, does this contribute to like conference finalist winning? Probably not, but you got a double-double tonight for the Knicks, so rookie of the year.
Yeah, but by the way, like when you get double-doubles for the Knicks, and if they're you know 18 and 10 double-doubles, like pretty good chance at rookie of the year. Like those are numbers.
Although you got to win some games. That's the other thing that Ja Morant, I like Ja's rookie of the year candidacy last year, and like the what that said about the award. I like the idea that. You got the counting stats fine, and we're guilty of paying too much attention to that. But, you know, they got to win some games in New York, too. I was going to say my favorite moment of the draft maybe was when Rachel Nichols, I think, was talking to Obi and essentially asked him why it was so meaningful. And I think he was somewhat emotional. And he just very plainly, he seemed confused by the question, and he very plainly looked at her as if she didn't know and said, well, yeah, I'm from New York. She's like, I realize that. Thank you.
I like him. It's the perfect fit for the Knicks because he's a CAA client too. So it's just perfect all around. He's the perfect Knick right now. I could easily see it. Also, like, let's not discount the Knicks narrative here.
Oh yeah, no, big time.
Linsanity was not going to happen in any other place.
And with Leon Rose there, now you'll have the old CAA hype machine behind everything they do. So we shall see. All right, gentlemen, this has been fun. It's been great to get back into it. Great to see your faces. I know it's weird times, but keep doing great work. And we will talk to you soon. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate you guys.
Thanks,